Thank you, Jennifer, and thank you. Actually, Jennifer gave me a light speed promotion. I'm actually not a doctor. I'm just an attorney, but
there's no
so I just wanted to clarify that. So this morning, I am going to be talking about legal tools and challenges relating to efforts to implement nutrition standards for food purchases or served by government. So by public spaces, that's what I'm talking about, government spaces. And this can mean food found in cafeterias or vending machines on government property, food provided by government departments at like meetings or events, or as well as institutional feeding. So first, I have to start off with my disclosures, of course. I have no personal financial relationships to disclose. And I want to tell you a little bit about the Public Health Law Center where I work. We are a nonprofit legal technical assistance center that's located at William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota, where it is, believe it or not, much colder than it is here now. And our mission is to improve law through the health through the power of law. We are mostly attorneys. Most of the folks up there you see are attorneys, but we do have some MPHs on our staff as well as, of course, admin folks. And what we do is we work with public health staff, government officials, consumer groups, researchers, and advocates both in Minnesota and around the country on designing and developing effective public health law and policies that are grounded both in good science and good law. While we are not traditional attorneys, we don't lobby and we don't represent people in court. We do occasionally get into court through friend of the court briefs when we support also public health laws that have been challenged, because as we all know, good public health laws often find themselves being challenged in court by the interest that they are curbing. And so we also do litigation strategy, and we do educational trainings like this one, as well as providing legal research for informational purposes and scholarship on public health law issues. Now, I want to start off with just touching on the objectives for the day for my portion of the session. I know it's probably been a while since you read the abstract that brought you here today, but I'm going to start giving you some background on how the law is being used to create healthier food and beverage standards for government places, and then give you some examples of a few jurisdictions that are doing it, and my co-panelists will elaborate on that, and then give you a very high-level overview of some of the legal questions that can come up when these efforts are going on. I want to start first off just asking, how many people are lawyers in the audience? Okay, good. Got several. How about researchers? All right. Advocates? Okay, public health or government folks? Okay, so we got kind of a even mix here, which is great. Is there anybody that I missed? You just shout it out if you want to. Okay. So in thinking about how the law can be a tool or a barrier for this work, I want to go back and take you a little bit back to your high school civics class 101 and talk about how our legal systems work. Since there's just a few lawyers in the room and many who are not, but hopefully this will be helpful. So as you, when you think about our legal system, you can think about how it's structured. There are several layers to it. That we have international law, we have tribal law, we have federal law, state, local law. It can be at the county, city level, even school boards, boards of health, all these entities out there that are making laws. And so when you're looking at engaging in this kind of work, it's important to understand that legal landscape. Of course, not all those layers are going to impact what you're doing, but there may be areas where they do. There may be areas where these different kinds of laws may overlap or create gaps, or where what you're doing could potentially create a conflict. So you need to be aware of how of that system works, because as the lawyers and the government folks in this room are familiar with, and with the way our legal system is set up, that if there's a conflict between some of these different levels of government, because generally our system is set up so that the broader system, like the federal law system, can trump the state or local system, and the state system can trump local or local laws. So if there's a conflict between these different layers, it's generally the broader level that's going to trump. But there are also some areas where that local level actually can take preeminence can in a way preempt those higher level laws. So you have to kind of understand how all that works. And then in our system, we also see this dynamic where even though we kind of in a way have this sort of top down system, we also have this very strong theme that good innovative work is done at the local level. And especially in this work of nutrition standards and healthy eating policy, we see a lot of great work that's happening at the local level that is really driving and inspiring work that is happening at the state or federal level. And so this is an area where local efforts are really important. So that's kind of, again, a very big picture look at this part of our legal framework. The other piece that's important to understand in thinking about this nutrition standard work is that, of course, we have most government entities have three branches. We have the legislative, executive, and the judicial branch. And each of those branches have a role in creating law and have a role in this work as well. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that here. So what we see with this nutrition standard work, that a lot of it is being done through the legislative branch, through laws being passed by state assemblies or city councils, county councils, as well as by agencies that are part of the executive branch that are doing the implementing through regulations and also issuing executive orders, exercising their authority as sort of the manager of the government to carry out this work. And of course, there's also a role for organizational policies, worksite wellness policies, and the use of contracts and requests for proposals and bids. And the legal principles are implicated there as well, because contracts create legal obligations, and wellness policies, as our human resources policies, are often shaped and implicated by the law. But for the most part, what we see in this work is that the work is being done through statutes and executive orders. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. Here I have some examples here of from different types of government, different levels of government, where this work is being carried out. And I want to explain a little bit about each one. So Seattle. In Seattle, we have examples where they're using the Seattle City Council is using their ordinance passing, their legislative authority to pass ordinances. One most recently to create a healthy vending policy for vending done on city property, which established 100% healthier or healthiest standard using the nutrition guidelines created by the Seattle King County Public Health Department. And they were building off of work that they had done 2 years earlier, where they passed an ordinance which involved adopting a contract with a vending company for their park vending facilities, which again used a 100% standard, but had the healthier and the healthiest nutrition standards were not decided based on the Seattle King County standards, but were actually contained in the contract, were defined within the contract. So that's an example, sort of different approaches that can be taken. Now, with California, we have an example of a state-level law which sets standards for vending on state government property. And that standard there was that at least 35% of the food and two-thirds of the beverages sold on vending machines on state property had to meet some kind of modest nutritional standards. But that's an example of sort of a statewide approach there. And then Washington, D.C. just recently passed a law and Katie's stand-in here is going to talk a little bit more about that, but setting really good nutritional guidelines based on some federal standards that 50% of all the food purchased or served by Washington, D.C. will meet these guidelines. And then finally, we have and tribes as well as doing this work. I know of a few examples, but one in particular of a tribe in Oregon, which recently passed a tribal resolution calling for 50%, again, 50% of the foods that were served or purchased by the tribal council and provided for meetings or events will meet certain nutritional standards. And then finally, I wanted to bring up a legislative approach that maybe people haven't thought too much about or heard about, but this is the idea of incorporating into, at the city level or county level, into comprehensive plans, healthy eating efforts into comprehensive plans. Now, comprehensive plans, for those of you who might not be familiar with them, are a tool that are used by many local governments to establish a sort of a vision for what they want their communities to look like and how they want them to grow and develop, and typically they're very long documents, and they're kind of living documents. They're always being changed, and typically they focus on things like community economic development and land use. But more and more communities are starting to think about incorporating health into these plans as well. And so I just recently heard of a great example of Des Moines, Washington. I'm from Iowa. I never knew there was another Des Moines, but Des Moines, Washington, where they included some information in their comprehensive plan about an assessment of the food environment in the community, and finding that it had too much junk food, and calling upon the city to make a commitment to establish nutrition standards for food in city-owned and operated facilities. And then, of course, there are some executive orders. Some of you have probably heard of the Washington example, and again, Jennifer is going to talk more about that. And the executive order that was recently passed is based on a WorkSite Wellness initiative that set nutrition standards for Washington State food served or sold by Washington agencies. And then, of course, New Orleans itself. Here we are, has an executive order in place that calls for the establishment of nutrition standards for food on food choices at City Hall and other city-owned parks. And is this, you can see there's not just the executive order is a key part, but there's also these implementation pieces, which are also very important. So when you're looking at these documents or these models, you have to remember it's not just the sort of the law, the order, the legislation, but you also have to look at how they're being implemented. Briefly, this is a question that comes up a lot, like what's the difference or what's the benefits of doing a statute or an executive order? And so this kind of just highlights some of the pros and cons of both. I mean, essentially it boils down to statutes tend to have more application. They cover the entire jurisdiction. The executive order will only cover the executive branch. Statutes, they are subject to that sausage-making process, you know, so what you start off with may not be what you end up with, so you have to kind of keep that in mind. With executive orders, there might be a little bit more control over that process because you're dealing with, you know, a more finite set of personalities. But the thing with statutes, of course, is that they can be harder to change. They can be changed, but again, that sausage making process is also sort of a protection against change. While executive orders can be rescinded by a new governor if that office changes. But one thing that I really want to talk about that they have in common is that it's easy to think that the law or the executive order is the goal. And that it's an important goal, but I want to emphasize that it's not the only one. Really, this work is about the journey. It's about the process. It's about engaging the stakeholders and assessing the environment and figuring out what your food distribution system looks like so you know what's practical and reasonable for your system, and getting something like this in place and then implementing it. So I just want to emphasize that, because a lot of people think if they win the order or the law, they've won the day. And finally, courts have a very minor role. We haven't really seen much there. One potential role there they have is potentially to protect policies that get in place. As more and more of these happen, we might see more challenges happen there, and so that would be the main role. And as a lawyer, of course, I had to include a case site. If you want to know more about that, you can ask me after the session. And then with this work, it's important to understand the wider legal context. We have all kinds of laws in the state food procurement process or local food procurement process that might impact, say, geographic preference laws, or laws that say you know the state should purchase a certain percentage of goods from the Department of Corrections or from women and minority-owned businesses. And one of those important preferences laws is the Randolph-Shepard Act, which is the federal law that gives priority to legally blind individuals to operate vending facilities on federal land. And so this means that if you see a vending machine or a cafeteria, a snack bar, any kind of food service on federal property, it's likely to be operated by a blind vendor. And of course, this law then gives blind vendors a huge stake in what happens with these operations and make them really important stakeholders. And so we have a fact sheet that we are doing with CSPI and the Heart Association about healthy vending in the Randolph-Shepard Act to kind of explain how that works. It will be coming soon on our website. It's going through a review process right now, and it's an update of an older version you might find if you Google it. And then we're also, with the Heart Association, doing a 50-state review of all the state blind vendor laws, because not only is there federal law, but many states have passed their own version of this law to apply it not just to federal property, but to state and sometimes even local property as well. So depending on the state, that law may apply to other kinds of property. And so this is a map that just kind of lays out the scope of the different state laws. And then just finally, I wanted to end with a word about preemption. You know, this is that concept of federal or state law trumping, say, local law. And, you know, we haven't seen it as an issue so much with this kind of work. But, I'll tell you, having worked in this area for now several years, nutrition policy, healthy eating policy is really controversial. And the industry response to many local efforts is to seek preemption. And so these are the states where preemptive laws have been passed, usually at the behest of the industry, food industry. With the ones, though, that are X'd out are ones where the states have either repealed those laws or actually those have been overturned. So there's been some victories there, even there. But I would say I don't anticipate that these kinds of laws are going to have much impact on this work, except for maybe the law in Wisconsin and Mississippi. There, the language there is so broad, it's kind of unclear. We're still trying to figure out what the scope of that law is. But it's just something to kind of keep your radar up on about as you do this work and paying attention to what might be happening in your legislature as this work takes on momentum and the industry starts to become more concerned about it. Again, I thank you for being here this morning. I want to emphasize with this kind of work, I have to say as a lawyer, the devil is always in the details. So if you have questions, please feel free to contact me or come up and talk afterwards. Emphasize again that even though I'm a lawyer and I love the law, I know that this creating these legal mechanisms is really is not your first step and it's not your last step. It's just one of the steps. And so I'm going to turn it over next to my next speaker who's going to talk more about some of the practical issues around and considerations around implementing these.